Today, super isn't what it was. The DFA Daily to the 25th of May, 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Before I start, don't forget tomorrow our live Q&A session at 8pm Sydney time, where I'll be joined by our property insider, Edwin Almeida. You can ask a question live or send them in ahead of time via the DFA blog. Meantime, balances in super funds are falling as stock markets gyrate and some withdrawals are taking place, either under the COVID survival plan or because people want to switch asset allocation. On the former, APRA updated its early superannuation withdrawal data today based on information for the period ended the 10th of May 2020 and from 177 funds who reported on a best endeavours basis. So far, $9 billion in payments have been made since the programme started, with an average withdrawal of $7,546 based on 1.34 million applications received or 1.18 million applications paid. The average processing time was 3.3 business days, with 94% of applications paid within 5 business days. The payment processing period is measured from the date the super fund receives the application from the ATO. In the week ended 26th of April, $5.1 billion in applications was received and $1.3 billion of applications paid. In the week, the 3rd of May, a cumulative $8.1 billion in applications were received and $6.2 billion were paid. And in the week ended the 10th of May, a cumulative $10 billion of applications were received and $9 billion were paid. 662,000 applications were received and 160,000 applications paid during the week of the 26th of April. Over 1 million applications were received and 809,000 applications paid during the week of the 3rd of May, and 1.3 million applications were received and 1.1 million applications paid during the week of the 10th of May. 19% of applications were processed within one business day, 12% in two, 15% in three, 40% in four, 8% in five, 2% in six, 1% in seven, 1% in eight, 1% in nine, and 1% in 10 or more. The fund level data shows that 146 of the 177 funds that submitted data made early release payments in the period since inception to the 10th of May. The 10 funds with the highest number of applications received from the ATO have made 975,000 payments worth a total of $5.96 billion, and the average payment of these funds was $7,664, and over 93% of those payments were made within 5 days. With an option to withdraw $10,000 before June and another $10,000 next financial year, the pressure on some funds will be immense because there has been quite a strong concentration in some sectors, for example, in the hospitality sector. Now, turning to the question of superfund performance and asset allocation, according to research released today, the majority of Australians believe their superannuation fund would protect their retirement savings from a downturn, according to global pensions and investment advisors Russell Investments. The research comes as fears around the erosion of Australia's retirement savings intensifies, with the latest figures from Chant West revealing the average growth in the balance fund dropped 9% in the month to March the 31st, and 10.1% for March 2020 quarter. While the Australian share market has since rallied to record its best month since 1988, April was still characterised by whipsawing volatility. Russell Investments surveyed more than 3,000 working Australians in January this year prior to the market's collapse to gauge their perceptions on investments within superannuation. A strong misconception was the belief that super funds automatically de-risk to protect members from potential losses during a market downturn, a view held by two-thirds of working Australians surveyed. Meanwhile, more than a third, actually 37%, believe their fund already manages their investments based on their own personal circumstances, even if they do not actively choose how their super is invested within their fund. Critically, the research found the majority underestimate the importance of asset allocation in driving returns. Just 1 in 5 people correctly identified asset allocation as one of the most important determinants in achieving adequate super savings for retirement, showing a lack of connection between how super is invested and retirement outcomes. Managing Director of Russell Investments in Australia, Jodie Hampshire, said the impact of COVID-19 had shed light on how exposed many Australians remain in today's modern defined contribution super environment, but it also gave clear direction on how the industry can do better. She said, enabling members to adopt more individual, goal-based investment strategies was an emerging path for global retirement plans to help members better manage their investment choices and thus retirement outcomes through inevitable market cycles. As an industry, she said, we can and should be doing more to help investors navigate this climate of increased uncertainty. For working Australians, asset allocation is one of the strongest factors driving retirement income adequacy. Therefore, having the right asset allocation at the right time is critical. Members who don't take on enough risk when they are able to could see their superannuation balances stagnate, while overly aggressive asset allocation at the wrong time can jeopardise a lifetime of savings. Ms. Hampshire said that asset allocation is often overlooked in industry discussions around retirement income adequacy compared to other considerations such as fees, which have a smaller influence on retirement outcomes. And the research shows that choosing investments within super remains a minefield for many working Australians, leading to misinformed choices or no choice at all. This is particularly the case in times of severe market uncertainty, where strong emotions and behavioural biases have a heavy hand in decision-making, she added. Other key findings from the research include that 67% of those surveyed did not know how their super is invested or they leave it to their fund's default approach. More than 1 in 5 at 21% did not know they could choose their investments in super. And those who have made an active investment choice are significantly more likely to have also set a goal for the amount of super they want to save or spend in retirement. And for those who have made an active investment choice within super, only 30% believe that they have the right investment experience to pick their own investments. And meanwhile, 28% still pick their own investments despite admitting that they don't have much investment experience. And when making their investment choices, 1 in 4 rely on help from a friend or relative with financial knowledge at 25%. And meanwhile, only 3 in 10 at 30% say they reference information from their super fund. According to Ms. Hampshire, even Australians' mandated super system will struggle to deliver adequate retirement outcomes for many Australians. She pointed out the figures from the World Economic Forum, which revealed the nation has a retirement saving gap of $1 trillion, expected to rise to $9 trillion by 2050. A key weakness of our current system is its inability to deliver investment strategies that address individual retirement goals. Super funds are serving up a one-size-fits-many approaches to investing that might look sensible on average, but in the real world, she says, nobody is average. While my super has helped nudge people into higher growth default options, the contributions of a 25-year-old entering the workforce might still be invested in the exact same way as a 62-year-old nearing retirement. The introduction of lifestyle or target date funds has been a step in the right direction. However, age-only strategies are designed for a group of individuals instead of delivering an optimal outcome for each and every individual, she said. Our next challenge is to efficiently deliver an approach to asset allocation that is more personalised to an individual's own retirement goal and to their particular financial situation. Ms. Hampshire said that the move to more personalised super would emulate other industries such as the retail and health wellness sectors, which have harnessed data and technology advances to offer a more personalized delivery of products and services to meet the unique needs of individuals. Ultimately, we see that personalized, goal-based investing in super is the next big step to helping even more Australians achieve the retirement lifestyle they deserve. Now, I have to say that forced savings into a super fund is not necessarily good news for many Australians, and frankly, in the current environment, they could probably do with the money direct. So I think there is a big debate here about the future of superannuation. And frankly, the super funds, of course, take fees quite a lot of the time, whether performance is good or whether performance is bad. And I also agree that many people have no idea what their money is invested in. This is an area that I think is not serving Australians well. And frankly, just changing the basis as recommended in their research is not going to solve the fundamental question. There's a much more critical question to be asked about the super fund and how it works in the future. Many people are just not being supported appropriately into old age. And yet, more and more people are going to be relying on this down the track at a time when property prices and the value in those properties are probably going to degrade. This has all the hallmarks of a significant crisis emerging. Now, in economic news, the ABS released early trade data today for goods, but not services for April. Exports remained elevated despite a partial pullback. The data is based on customs information and is not seasonally adjusted. Goods exports was down 12.2% after a 29.6% rise last time. That was based on a revised record high figure in March 2020 of $35.7 billion, equating to a fall in dollar terms of around $4.4 billion. Gold was a key driver, down $1.7 billion after a $2.5 billion spike last time. Weaker commodity prices were also a factor. In March, exports rebounded from disruption, iron ore from Cyclone Damien, and gold from China's lockdown from late January through to February. Goods exports adjusted down in the order of 7.7%. By way of context, that has goods exports 0.5% above the level at the end of 2019, a relatively resilient performance given everything we've seen. Goods imports fell 5.4% after a rise of 13.3% in March, reflecting a fall of $1.3 billion thanks to lower commodity prices, with fuels down $0.7 billion. However, imports from China increased after decreases were observed in early 2020, and there is significant uncertainty as to how this will finally translate. Perhaps down by 2.5%, that has imports down by 9% from the end of 2019, a sizable fall on weaker domestic demand. And we can probably expect to still see a goods trade balance, though down from a record high of $10.1 billion in March, perhaps to around $8 billion, but we'll see. And across the ditch, New Zealand consumer spending fell through the floor as the economy went into lockdown and is expected to be subdued for the foreseeable future, according to Stats New Zealand. Spending on vehicles, on eating out, and on accommodation away from home fell sharply in the March 2020 quarter in the lead up to the COVID-19 lockdown. After adjusting for price and seasonal effects, the volume of total retail sales fell 0.7% in the March 2020 quarter after a relatively flat December 2019 quarter. This is the largest fall in total volume sales in 8 years, the retail statistics manager Kathy Hicks said. Motor vehicle and parts retailing had the largest fall in sales volumes of all the 15 retail industries, down 7.5% in the March 2020 quarter. This was followed by the hospitality industry, with food and beverage services down 6.7% and accommodation down 9.3%. Efforts to slow the spread of COVID-19 led to the closure of all non-essential businesses from midnight March 25th, Ms. Hicks said. This hit car yards, takeaways, restaurants, hotels and motels hard, with sales dropping sharply. These falls may continue into the June 2020 quarter, with a record fall in monthly electronic card sales already reported for April, as many businesses went into hibernation because of the COVID-19 lockdown. Hospitality industries have also been hit by the lack of international visitors arriving due to travel restrictions since early February, which were meant to protect New Zealanders against COVID-19. And these falls were offset by a record increase in supermarket and grocery stores, up 8.5%. Supermarkets stayed open during the level 4 COVID-19 lockdown as an essential business, and widespread reports stated people stocked up on foods and supplies as the quarter progressed. Including price changes, the seasonally adjusted value of total retail sales fell 0.4% at $89 million in the March 2020 quarter, after a 0.5% or $120 million rise in the December 2019 quarter. Sales values for motor vehicles and parts retailing were down 7.4% at $248 million. And this was followed by the two hospitality industries, food and beverage services, down 5.8% or $179 million, and accommodation down 11% at $127 million. Supermarkets and grocery stores had a record increase in sales value, up 9.7% at $514 million. In actual terms, the value of total retail sales was $24.8 billion in the March 2020 quarter, up 3.4% or $819 million from the March 2019 quarter. And retail sales fell the most in the Auckland and Otago regions in the March 2020 quarter. This coincided with border closures reducing overseas visitor arrivals and a fall in the number of foreign students coming to New Zealand for tertiary studies. Travel restrictions hit the hospitality sector in tourist destinations such as Auckland, which is often the first port of call for many overseas visitors. The Auckland region had the largest dollar value fall this quarter, down 0.9% or $86 million. Otago had the next largest fall in dollar terms, down 4.1% or $57 million. This quarter's fall was the largest for Otago since the region's series began in June 2011. Otago's fall in sales reflects the significant drop in overseas tourists to the Queenstown area and fewer overseas and New Zealand students returning to Dunedin for university at the start of the year. An economist said the drop was not as bad as had been expected, but consumer spending would be subdued for some time as financially hard-pressed households preserve their money. New Zealanders are going to be reluctant to get out and spend for some time yet, especially with a lot of households facing job losses, Westpac's senior economist Satish Ranchhold said, as reported by RNZ. There is also a lot of nervousness about the economic climate, and that's going to be a drag on spending levels for some time yet. And meanwhile, struggling appliance and household retailer Smith City confirmed it will close 7 stores as it got itself in shape to seal a deal that will see it sold to a private buyer for $60 million. The stores closed will include those at Mount Wellington, Lower Hutt, Christchurch and Invercargill. Meanwhile, Australia's retail giant Wesfarmers said it would be closing a large number of its discount furniture chain stores, with others to be converted to Kmart stores. It did not make it immediately clear whether its New Zealand branches of either chain would be affected. And here is a real surprise, not more spruiking from the property sector. Australians could receive $40,000 cash to build their own homes if a plan by construction industry bosses goes ahead. The Building and Construction Stimulus Package has been proposed by the Master Builders Association and is worth more than $13 billion, a spokesperson for the organisation, Will Frogley, told Daily Mail Australia. The package had been designed to boost the struggling economy and save around 635,900 jobs that were lost during the coronavirus crisis. While the group has presented a number of measures to the federal government in a report commissioned by consulting firm Ernst & Young, the cash boost is a major component of the plan. All the measures are important, but the most important is the $40,000 grant, he said. This is because building new houses provides a massive multiplier effect in the economy that is virtually unmatched. He explained that more than 100 people work on the average suburban house, including plumbers, electricians, carpenters and material suppliers. If they have money in their pocket, they can go out and spend it. It's absolutely crucial. Other proposed measures include repairing cladding on audited buildings, funding the removal of asbestos, cutting charges for developers, and increasing the money learning institutions can spend on infrastructure. According to the report, modelling shows a return of $2.34 for every $1 the government invests in the stimulus package. The package would generate an estimated $30.9 billion in gross domestic product and create 105,500 construction jobs. The MBA wants the National Cabinet of Federal, State and Territory Leaders, which will meet this week, to consider its stimulus proposal for the industry. And building and construction is shaping up to be one of the industry's worst hit in the long term by the COVID-19 economic crisis, CEO Denita Yuan said in a statement. We know from previous downturns that it takes four times longer for our industry to recover than the rest of the economy. And she also explained work for builders and tradespeople in 2021 was already evaporating, and the forecast for 21-22 looks bleak. There are around 400,000 building businesses in Australia, employing 1.2 million people. The Master Builders is also seeking the establishment of a special task force to fast-track construction activity. Now, on Sunday, Prime Minister Scott Morrison said he would work with unions and industry leaders with job creation plans. The other curve we have to work on is the job curve, and we need to do things that create jobs. And what I'm interested in doing is working with anyone in this country who wants to work with me to create jobs, he said. Any premier, any chief minister, any union leader, any business leader, anyone who wants to work with me to create jobs, we've got a partnership. To which I replied, no, actually, we need investment in real infrastructure, not more rabbit hutches, bearing in mind we already have more than 1 million spare homes in Australia, with more being built even now. This is pure self-interest. It should be ignored. And finally, the Hong Kong question, in the context of our relationship with China, needs careful thought, not least a consideration of the potential for financial fallout, especially in Chinese money abroad being repatriated. Damien Bowie from Credit Suisse looked at this today. He says that Hong Kong capital outflows could eventually weigh on world excess liquidity, but they are unlikely to weigh immediately. Some might even argue that the events in Hong Kong might be specific to Hong Kong rather than the broader complex, and that flows out of the city might simply show up in another gateway city instead. We are not necessarily, he says, this optimistic given Hong Kong's links to China and China's significance to the global economy, but nevertheless we do recognise that the argument is out there. We think that in order for the Asian US dollar savings glut, or more precisely its unwind, to present a clear and present danger for the world, it has to do so via emerging market crowding out in the first instance, and then via reductions in purchases of US dollar assets, whether property, bonds or stocks. But we really question whether the unwind will work out by causing US Treasury yields to immediately spike higher and US mortgage demand to fall. In part, this is because reported mortgage demand in the Fed Senior Loan Officer's survey is actually quite robust at present, unlike its very weak state pre-GFC. But more fundamentally, on the issue of higher yields, we note that the US Treasury does not need China or any other Asian central bank to finance its borrowing. Rather, the US Treasury is funded by the Fed with or without quantitative easing. To be sure, China is a large holder of US Treasuries, and any selling by such a large owner could cause price dislocations in the short term, but if there is any doubt, we should note that China is not a forced seller of US Treasuries. And if the PBOC needs US dollar liquidity, it can repo its US dollars held in Treasuries with the Fed via the Foreign and International Monetary Authority repo facility, effectively bypassing the broader market. And even if the PBOC were to fire sell its Treasuries on market, the Fed is present as a buyer of last resort via QE. Still, positioning for a world awash with excess liquidity, we are very concerned about degeneration in US-China relations longer term. But near term, we are focusing on the state of world excess liquidity, stoking inflation risk and higher demand for inflation hedges like commodities. We think that there is a lot going on in the world with fiscal stimulus and central bank balance sheet expansion to drive world excess liquidity higher in the core, if not the periphery. For example, even the Europeans are taking emergency measures to stimulate distressed economies using funds raised through large-scale and mutual German and French bond issuance in a European Central Bank or ECB QE environment, effectively approaching a temporary fiscal union. And for all the negativity surrounding China's scrapping of a 2020 growth target, it is easy to miss the announcement of more fiscal stimulus, but specifically on US dollar funding conditions, we are comfortable that the Fed is doing a lot to supply the world with the US dollar liquidity that it needs via portfolio channels, notwithstanding the threat of US-China tensions turning off the spigot via the trade channel. Indeed, the Fed could be doing enough to defer the adverse consequences of deteriorating US-China relations for a bit longer, especially if it can take advantage of a unique opportunity to devalue the US dollar. And we're also wary of the risk that trade wars will move out of the deflationary illiquidity phase into an inflationary supply chain disruption and reorganization phase. Within the ASX 200, we are overweight resources. Interestingly, although Hong Kong equities initially sold off aggressively on reports of China's plans to revise security laws, there was little follow-through to US markets. And in any case, if we are wrong about the potentially negative effects of the US-China tensions on world excess liquidity and commodity prices, we are likely to be equally wrong about the harmful effects on Chinese demand for property and related exposures. In other words, there is a degree of protection from China's risks. So to conclude, I'm not sure anybody quite knows how the China-US situation will play out, but what I can say for sure is that the Fed is continuing its path of throwing more liquidity in as required and will continue to do so. Unlimited liquidity is what they've promised. And that effectively continues to support the US economy and support the financial system. The problem I have with all this is that it doesn't necessarily translate back through to the real economy, real households, and real businesses. And as I discussed with Harry Dent the other day, the problem there is that all of this flow of liquidity into the financial system essentially is not inflationary, it's actually deflationary, and it could lead ultimately to a significant reassessment of asset values. We are in a very uncertain period of financial history at the moment, and I am not sure that some of the traditional logic will necessarily play out as we think. And coming back to superannuation, overlay those risks on the future returns from the superannuation funds that exist today. I just don't think they're fit for purpose, and many people will discover, I think too late, that the returns that they're going to get will be significantly lower than they might have hoped or need. In fact, very few people really watch their superannuation fund close enough, have a good enough understanding of where it's invested, or indeed take any proactive management of the fund. So I would say this, if you haven't thought through where your fund is placed, what the asset allocation mix is, and how much you're paying, then you're doing yourself a major disservice. And in the current environment, it's important to know these questions. Trouble is, of course, it's hard to get the information, and quite often super funds are very happy to take your money, but don't want to pony up the information that they should be providing. I think the whole industry sector needs a reboot. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.